Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer and poet Lisa Harris. Harris is the author of The Geechee Girls, Allegheny Dream, and The Raven's Tale. And these three novels make up the Quest Trilogy, which was published by Ravenna Press. Her most recent book is a first collection of poetry entitled Traveling Through Glass. And it includes artwork by Patricia Brown, who is a member of the local State of the Art Gallery. Traveling Through Glass was published recently by Cuga Lake Books, and Harris's poetry has appeared in many journals, including The Co-Review and Vending Machine Press. And welcome to the show. Nice to see you.
Good to be here.
Now, Traveling Through Glass is your first collection of poetry. Why did you decide to put artwork in it? How did that enhance the words?
I like collaborating with people, and I like having relationships through art. And so most of my friends are visual artists, not so many writers for friends. I don't know what that means. So when I finished the poems and was almost done, I showed them to a friend and I said, do you want to do a collaboration or an installation on this? At that point, I wasn't thinking a book. And she said, sure. She said, well, no, I don't want to do this. And I said, okay. So she went to sleep. She woke up the next day and she'd had a dream where the poems danced for her.
Wow.
And so she goes to Bennington to like a retreat, and she stays at the Saltonstall twice a year. So she got models to come and they read the poems over and over and over again till they felt they knew them. And then the dancers danced while Patty drew ambidextrously to their motions. And of the poems, there's a black and white drawing, and then there's a painting that goes with each one of the 13 poems.
What an interesting collaboration, instead of just a straight poetry book. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It really does enhance and complement the words.
And we had fun.
That counts as well. Now, the first section of Traveling Through Glass is called Counting, and you really do build poems around numbers and the myths around numbers. And to tell us, well, where did that idea come from?
As a child, I was impulsive, and my mother called me her little scatterbrain. And so I didn't always pay attention, which drove her crazy. And so she told me that I had to, when I wanted to get up, I needed to count. And she never said impulse control, but she was a teacher, so I'm sure she knew about that. And so all my life, when I'm impatient or upset or something that isn't good, I tend to count. And I was going through sort of a difficult period last year, some family things. And I thought, well, maybe I should just count. And then I thought, or turn them into poems. So
it's a fascinating idea.
So
I absolutely love it.
I was going to do 1 to 10. And my friend Patty said, oh, you have to have one for 0. And John McNeil's a friend of mine from St. Paul's. And he said, well, you should have 12. So I ended up writing 13 total.
You didn't listen to either one of them. I love it. Well, I want to have you read a poem from this section called Counting from Traveling Through Glass. And this one is a riff on zero, and it's called Nothing and Everything. Tell us a little bit about it. This is my favorite.
Oh.
Yeah, it's
okay.
One of my favorites.
Well, this one sort of wouldn't allow lines. And so it became almost a meditation. And what I did is I would read for 2 days everything I could about the number, whatever the number was.
Mm-hmm.
And I love yellow tablets and blue pens. So I would just write everything down I could think of or find on the internet, in books, in the Bible. And then I would go to sleep. And I would wake up the next day, have a cup of coffee, and start to compose. And so 0 to 12, those poems, took me 3 months to write. So I did it very intensely and intentionally while we were moving back to Ithaca. We'd been living in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Well, let's hear Nothing and Everything, the riff on zero.
Nothing and everything. Zero holds a place of absence, a midpoint between plus one and minus one. Look closely at a pie, a cake, a world, things we cut up. Once made, they cannot be enlarged, but they can be shared in different parts, in different pieces, in different chunks. Time, amorphous and precise, teases us as it stretches beyond us, measures us by ticks and talks, speaking a language of ticking and talking. We are zero, a place of absence and presence, a midpoint between eternity and before now. We set time traps for each other and for ourselves. We call them deadlines, milestones, anniversaries, paydays, Sabbaths, birthdays, national holidays, elections, weekends, and funerals. Zero, naught, zilch, zip, aught. We leave and never arrive, as Zeno predicted, reductio ad absurdum. Whenever we reach where we have been, we still have farther to go. No tortoise needed in this race, absurdly running and never arriving until death reaches out and snatches us. Prior to that moment, we are arrows in a motionless moment, fixed on a spinning point called time.
I love that. I think that is absolutely beautiful. Now, I noticed that, and people will hear a few more of these poems, there's a very spiritual, even a religious bent to a lot of these poems. Is this some kind of a transformation for you, or does it have to do with your, you know, the preoccupation with the numbers?
I think it may be both. I'm very spiritual and empathetic, and always have been. I used to hide it a lot, or pretend it wasn't so.
Oh, that's a protective thing, yeah.
Sure. And then probably in my 30s, I began to appreciate that maybe it was my way into things. And it was. Then I had to figure out how it was my way out of certain other things. And so I've done a lot of meditative work and had some good fortune with spiritual leaders. And I, in my 40s, returned to my ancestral church, which is the Methodist Church, because it was familiar. It had, at its basis, do no harm. In fact, in John Wesley's words, it's do all the good you can for as long as you ever can. Mm-hmm. And I don't always do that, but I try to. So it makes me feel centered and at home.
Yeah, and it's coming out in your poetry in beautiful ways. I mean, it's not that preachy kind of religious stuff.
Good.
It's very, very spiritual and calming almost.
Right,
I can sense
a
calmness.
Yeah,
I can sense that from you. Now, when I first met you, I thought of you mainly as a fiction writer, but I know poetry has been a thread through your life forever, probably.
Right.
Is that true?
It is.
Because you almost write poetry almost like a fiction writer. It feels like there's a plot.
And people say that the fiction seems like it's a poem. So I think that it's, you know, sort of a merger. I always wrote poetry until I was 30. Only poetry.
Mm.
And my first poem was published in sixth grade at Snowshoe Elementary, and it was called The White Wedding Dress, and it was a morbid little, you know, thing. And then my mom died when I was 30, and she was a storyteller, but she didn't write much. So I ended up almost writing down everything she'd ever said to me as stories. And then the stories just kept coming, and I wrote poems occasionally. And recently I've been writing, I'd say the last 20 years, I've been writing a lot of poetry.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can tell that there's a mixture. I mean, I know some poets who have tried fiction and then they go back to poetry. Mm-hmm. Fiction's not for me, but you've been able to do both. And it comes out in all the different genres.
Yeah, good. Yeah. I had a colleague one time who, we weren't friends. And I don't think we liked each other at all, as a matter of fact. And one day she said to me, you can't be a poet and a fiction writer. You have to choose one. Nobody can do both. And it made me angry. And I'm a little belligerent. I try not to be, but I fail. And so that made me more determined to get really good at both of them, just because I wanted to prove her wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But a lot of people don't cross over. And when they do, they just do it once or so. You know, you never know what's going to happen. I want to have you read another one from Traveling Through Glass. I love that title, by the way. This is another from the counting section, and you do a riff on the number 2. And this one's called Balance.
Okay. So Balance was fun for me to write because it felt a little bit like a riddle.
Hmm.
So this is number 2, Balance. If 2 is too many and 1 is too few, where is the balance between the 2? 2 angels follow each person in life and write down good deeds and bad. 2 silver cords hold our souls to our bodies, 1 linked to our brains and 1 linked to heaven. If what we give in turn becomes what we receive, is that justice? She stands before us holding her scales, balanced and empty. What if we unlearn opposites and duality as our primary frame of thought? Our movements become joining, attracting, accepting, shifting, and holding, then letting things go to the sound of 2 silver trumpets ordered by God and made by Moses. Is there sound harmony? and to what are we called? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth is, after all, reciprocal and reductive. I will keep my eye and tooth, you keep yours. If division is independence, is connecting imprisonment? If we flip these, are they not also true? Connecting frees and dividing captures. Two mats frame two pairs painted on a purple tray. Two eyes watch and two hands hold, both insufficient and too much. And lovers who yearn even after years together crave smell and touch to feel alive, rip open pomegranates and gasp at ruby seeds, too many to count.
Beautiful. I love it.
Thank you.
I love it. You know, you put a little bit of rhyming in your poetry. Is that deliberate, or is the thought just coming traveling that way?
Sometimes it happens, and then I build on it. There's a poem that I read at the Seneca Falls Women's March last year as a benediction to that, which is a long poem. And in it, it almost sounds like a Dr. Seuss rhyme pattern because I got going and it got going. And it's also a juxtaposition for it to sound like Dr. Seuss when it's about anything that is, you know, things that aren't funny,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I think I do it more consciously, or it takes over, because I've listened to a lot of songs.
Yeah.
You know, and songs.
Well, that would absolutely do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to go back to the fact that you have gotten back in touch with a religion you were brought up in. Are you actually reading the Bible again, or just memories of the Bible? Because there are a lot of biblical references in these poems.
Right.
And I find that very interesting because they're integrated so well into these pieces without being, you know, preachy.
Well, my grandmother was a wonderful person. I mean, my parents were too, but I stayed with my grandmother a lot. And she was never preachy, but she was amazing. And every morning she got up and she read the Bible, and she read the Bible over and over again, you know, year
after
year.
As people do, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Not many people I knew did that.
Mm.
And she also kept her notes in green ink for what she was trying to grow. That was symbolic for her, I think. She was a farmer.
Mm.
So I stopped reading the Bible at 15. Then I took a class called Divisional Seminar at Bard, and we had to read the entire Old and New Testament as literature instead of as religion. And I'd had to read it as religion at my boarding school, which was a Methodist school. Anyway, I think that I still have those cadences from the King James Version because I can't read the Bible in any other translation.
Mm.
It doesn't sound right to me. And I love finding unusual and obsolete verbs. I have a verb wall in my study. And so I love the cadences, and I find it calming. So the Psalms particularly are calming to me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lisa Harris. She is a writer and poet, and we are now discussing her first collection of poetry called Traveling Through Glass. You know, many poets I've talked to, many poets I've read have said, if you're going to publish a book and you don't go out and give readings and don't go out and do live events, you might as well throw the book in the trash. So how do you feel about that? Do you feel like the live reading is a huge component as a poet?
I guess I think it's a huge component. If I weren't reading it to anyone, I'd still have to write them. It's almost, I think compulsion's overused or it's seen negatively. It's a good compulsion for mm-hmm. me. You know, it's trying to make order out of disorder, sense out of nonsense, or accepting that there is nonsense and disorder, but I can make it prettier in a poem. I don't know. So far, people have seemed excited about this, and there actually are three readings set up already that sort of just happened more or less effortlessly.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you have to push and push, and sometimes things just open.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people talk about how they dread having to do their own PR and trying to set up this stuff. But, you know, poetry was an art that was supposed to be mm-hmm. verbalized, mm-hmm. you know, an oratory kind of art from the beginning. So
absolutely.
I understand that. I mean, and some people understand it better when the poet can put the inflection and the emphasis and
right.
the intention in their own voice.
I think it's prettier and more alive when it's spoken. But I think if you write it really well, you can maybe have it hold up on the page.
Yeah. And a lot of poets don't know how to read their work. I've talked about that before, that some poets, uh-huh. they ruin their work in some ways by not knowing how to phrase in some cases. And Mary Oliver is the exception, of course. She can write a book, and we don't really expect her to do anything because it'll sell millions. I want to have you read another counting poem. This one's the number sixth, and it's called Connection.
This was a really hard poem to write. The number didn't cooperate. When I researched six, I just couldn't seem to find things. I spent much more time writing this. And then I stumbled onto an old Norse myth, and it made me understand something about immortality. a limited understanding, but, you know. So this one is called Connection, number six. If you believe it took 6 days to create the universe, you are not alone. You are connected to an old story and all who have considered it. You hang by a thread to a tale told over and over again. Thou shalt not kill, the sixth commandment, is Midrash. In Midrash considers gossip as a weapon that kills. Watch how and when and where you use words. The weave and the braid wrap truth, lies, and fear into a formidable chain. Imagine you are a bee living in a six-sided cell. Your job is to carry nectar home to make it into honey. Or what if you were part of a water crystal, a snowflake, a prong on the Star of David, one-sixth of an entirety? Consider being blind and craving the connection formed when others read the written word. Your fingertips become your eyes as they trace and decode six dots placed in two columns of three dots each, some raised, some lowered, a silent telegraphing to your heart and mind, bringing letters into words, words into sentences, sentences into meaning. You receive entire worlds. You stack and sort, merge and discard, and then you read the terrifying Norse myth of the Fenris wolf held tight by a leash, made of six things that no longer exist, braided now into a metal chain to bind them and him. Footfalls of cat, beard of a woman, roots of a mountain, long sinews of a bear, breath of a fish, and spit of a bird. The Fenris wolf watches you with yellow eyes. You feel its smooth, sharp teeth around your wrist, biting off your hand. The thrust sword is now lodged in your throat. You are bound to a rock until doomsday, when you had been hoping for a world without end.
That's a very complex one. I can see why it took you a long time to write that. It really is. It's fascinating in its complexity.
I can see the wolf so clearly. And I think, you know, as I've aged, I've gotten greedier about time. And sometimes I think, oh, I just want to live forever. And then in that myth, the person chained does live forever, but in a horrible, horrible way. And so it keeps me mindful of what I wish for.
I can understand that, yeah. The thought of living forever, ooh, yeah. I don't know about that. I think about vampires. Now, you moved out of the Finger Lakes for a time. You went to Pennsylvania for a little while. Did that move affect the way you write? Did it do anything to your senses, you know?
Well, it did, actually. I didn't grow up in Pittsburgh, but Pittsburgh was a place that was a good city to go to from Snowshoe. And being back in Pennsylvania reminded me, in ways I hadn't anticipated, of all kinds of things I'd forgotten about who I was, where I came from. I know that sounds silly, maybe, but...
No, it doesn't. It makes perfect sense.
It was really healing to be there and to have adventures and have people know that C-R-E-E-K is Crick. And you can spell it Creek, but nobody says it that way. And I wasn't working. It was the first time I didn't work full time. And so I actually had my own studio, and I finished two novels while I was there. I started four new ones. I wrote these poems in counting while I was there. And I was able, I think because I was near the Allegheny Mountains, to, I don't know, see things clearly.
Yeah.
And that's
clearly inspired, right? I mean, obviously.
Yeah, I think so. And the grace of that, I believe, is I feel that way here now, and I'm really glad to be back here. And I think I did some kind of healing that I didn't even know I was doing.
Ah. So was that trip a hiatus? When you left, I thought you were gone for good. Was it just a hiatus? Or?
Yeah, I guess. You know, yeah. We were there about 2.5, 3 years, mm-hmm. and some things in that weren't working out very well. And we decided we would do something that just made us happy. We're blessed to have lots of good friends. And people said, why don't you just come home? Ah. And that was a flip for me because home had always been Pennsylvania, even though I've lived here in New York State for a long time now. Went to college here. And so now I feel like I reclaimed what was broken or chipped and returned to a place that is now home to me. It redefined home.
Yeah, full circle.
Yeah.
Or zero, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah, and no Fenris wolf around. Like, just leave those where they are.
I want to have you read a final poem from the collection. And this one is not one of the number poems. It's called Raw, and it's from the last section of the book, and it's the last poem in the book.
Right. So the third section in the book is called Seeking. I was having trouble coming up with the title for the poetry collection, and I was reviewing poems to go in this section, and this is where I got the title. It's called Raw, and I wrote it for Jeffrey. 1. A lightning rod protects the barn, creating a low resistant path to ground, without allowing fire, but seeking a safe way down. The route is obvious once known. 2. I catch, hold, throw zigzagged lightning bolts, gold and sharp, grabbed from the center of the cyclone I have entered. I drink liquid glass, inhale and exhale wind, dust myself with dirt, and wear a ring of fire, dancing to what I hope is not the last dance. 3. Wind feeds the soul of trees. Without it, no whispering pines, no rustling leaves. Instead, silent and caged, trees hold their souls erect. Each tree would remain alone without wind. Underground, a root might cross, but there is no guarantee. 4. Scarves receive purpose from the wind, warming necks, holding chins, caressing hair. Wind insists, and scarves sometimes succeed and sometimes fail. 5. Fire water burns as it goes down. Beneath sky, underground, within these depths I begin. 100 spinning atoms afloat, without and within. I choose the closet of love to live in with you. I shatter patterned windows and let white light, screaming wind, cooling water, and you, my earth, in.
That's beautiful. Did you want to end with that poem because it was more hopeful and more full of light, do you think? Why was that the last poem? It's more personal. I know that.
It's more personal. I wrote it, how many years ago? I don't know, 7 years ago, maybe. But it seems that the themes in it also thread themselves through those counting poems. There seemed to be sort of a, what's that called, a closure? It's not quite the right word, but
yeah,
it flips it.
Yeah.
It flips it back in.
Yeah. Oh, like full circle almost. I mean, it comes back around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Now that you've done this theme, are you going to do another theme? You had the numbers. Now what might
I move on to? Yeah. I was fortunate to get... I co-wrote a grant with my friend Susan Wisend, who is also a visual artist, and we were at a residence north of Barcelona for the month of July, and we are working on a collaborative piece that explores extinction, the Cayuga watershed, divinity, I don't know, lots of big things, and so she was, it's a printmaking workshop, but they also allow writers to come, and so I wrote a new what would be a book-length poem to go with her art.
Ah.
So we were creating sort of simultaneously for that.
Uh-huh.
And I think she has a show set up for sometime in 2018. I don't have the poem completed yet, very close. So when I get it completed, I'll shop it to presses, see if anyone wants to print it.
Yeah. So you are going to continue collaboration, and it sounds like themes are going to be in the future as well.
Yeah.
You know, I know you've gone to Saltonstall and you've gone to some residencies. Well, what does that mean to you as a writer? Are you somebody who needs to have deliberate places to write, or do you spontaneously carry a tablet around and write down ideas all the time?
I think I do both. And I think what happened in Spain, for example, I'm not as high energy as I used to be, but I still have pretty good energy. I'm thankful for that. Mm-hmm. So while I was there, I was supposed to work on the poem, and I did. And I did tons of research because it's an examination of what we need to do also without being preachy, but being conscious of the earth. But while I was there, I started two new novels.
So you started doing what?
I started writing two new novels.
Oh.
And so one is called Imagine a Castle. And it is research and sort of also biography, autobiography, about the Deo Huguenots. Mm. That's my husband's family. And I woke up one morning and I had the first three paragraphs composed in my head. I just got up, went to the table, and started writing it. And that's always so cool.
Oh, it is exciting,
isn't
it?
That's very exciting. And I've also been working on a mystery that I worked a lot on over there. I never seem to finish it, but I don't know. It's still fun to write it.
Uh-huh. So you can write anywhere. I mean, you go to some of these retreats.
Yeah.
Because you can focus.
Well, they're more concentrated.
Yeah.
I can't garden, although I did take care of their geraniums for them while I was there, you know, because I just do stuff, you know.
I mean, almost anything is conducive to getting the mind going, as far as
right.
I can tell with the writers that I've spoken with.
Right.
You know, I mean, you don't really have to. People who think they have to sit in one place with a perfect desk, a perfect pad of paper, are putting off writing, right?
Right.
I would say.
I think so. I have a place like that set up, but I don't always show up to it because I'm writing outside.
Yeah. You know? I know. The people set themselves up for failure because they'll never be the perfect place.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean?
Well said.
Yeah. Yeah. We're almost out of time. Do you feel like poets can save the world? There are some people who think poetry and art can save the world. What is your feeling? We're in such a chaotic time.
I think they help. I think they sometimes help each individual who's doing the art. And so that's one person at a time, right?
Yeah.
And then if the poetry speaks to somebody else, or the painting or the sculpture or the music, then that's a couple more people. And I think art comes from love instead of scarcity. Mm. And art comes from love instead of hate. And so I think it's may not do it, but it's our hope. I think good food could save the world if we shared it. You know, I think lots of things could help make the world better, and we need to focus.
Yeah.
I try to focus, you know, really.
I understand that.
I'm worried.
I think everybody is. Mm. Anybody who's conscious is worried. And so I'm so glad that the arts are still trying to fill in the dark places.
Yes.
Yeah. Contact information if people want to get in touch with you. And where can they get your book?
Well, the book is at Buffalo Street Books, and there's going to be a reading there in March.
Oh, good.
I think it's March 9th. You can get it on Amazon. My email address is lisaharris.harris52@gmail.com. And if people write to me, I will always write back.
That's great. Well, Lisa Harris, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a pleasure to see you again. And the book is beautiful. Go out and get it. It will soothe your soul. Again, I've been talking to poet and writer Lisa Harris, and we've been talking about her new book called Traveling Through Glass, a great, great poetry collection. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.